first, I want to mahalo you and the crew at OIVI for taking us on the voyage with you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been really it's our honor. This has been the chance of a lifetime to be able to spend this much time with the canoe and get to go to these places we'd never get to go.
So awesome. So, you know, help me go through the decision-making mm-hmm. process, about the route even. Mm-hmm. Look at all the things you have to consider.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people get frustrated with it when it shifts schedules and things like that. But ultimately, the weather controls everything. So as an example, like, you know, me and you, we live here, you know, nice climate. You know, it's always 80 degrees and, you know, partly cloudy, winter and Malka showers. But in the rest of the world, weather does dictate what you're going to wear, how you're going to act, what car or what vehicle you're going to take to work. And certainly on a voyaging canoe, what path you're going to take. And that's because there are all these different considerations that you have to throw into the mix when you're talking about starting a voyage like this. But first and foremost is, what are the weather conditions that are necessary to be successful? So when Nainoa folks started to look at the meteorology to see what it would take, it was basically, and if you look at the route, it's very clear that they were trying to stay out of the tropical cyclone and hurricane seasons in the northern and southern hemispheres. And so we basically weaved through each year, staying either north or south of the equator to stay out of those seasons.
You had to plan the route to be in certain places at certain times of year.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why we ended up holding in New Zealand for so long, was to wait out the hurricane season there and then go again. We were there for 5 or 6 months. Also because it was a great educational opportunity. And then New Zealand is so huge that there are so many communities to go to, but it was also to wait out the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the base for it. And then you start to fill in what's possible and where there are connections. And then that goes into story and what fits. And, you know, and then there's about 22 more layers of stuff that you have to consider.
Piracy. Gosh.
You know, depth of the water, you know, eastern seaboard. You know, our escort vessel was drafting 9 feet. And, you know, if you're going to stay in what they call out there the ditch, you know, the inside the intercoastal waterway, most of that stuff is less than 10 feet. And so we had to find a new escort vessel to be able to make that trip. Certainly piracy, you know, there's all these considerations you have to take that layer on top of each other. You know, is the place safe? Can you access fresh drinking water? Can you access propane? In different countries, they have different propane adapters. And so some places you can't get the kind of propane you need into the bottle you need to connect to the stove to just heat water. Mm-hmm. And down to that level of detail. It's crazy.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And then you get those moments like the Potomac.
Oh, my gosh. You know?
Were you thinking George Washington at all in the back of your mind?
We went right by his house, Mount Vernon. We went right by there. And that was a really contrasty day. You know, we go by on the left-hand side on the hill, there's Mount Vernon. And then on the right is Piscataway, where all the Native peoples. Some tribes hadn't come together for many decades, but they did for us to welcome us to this place.
How did that happen? Was it your ed team advance work there that got the word?
You know, it had to do with, I honestly believe it has to do with the mana of the canoe at the base of it. And so when people hear about the canoe coming, they put their best version of themselves forward and they come with aloha. All over the world. And so when you get to a place like Piscataway, the idea of the canoe and this audacious dream of this canoe that's coming around the long way to the East Coast inspired everyone to say, hey, we need to welcome these people the proper way. And, you know, and one of the things that I really admire about the voyage, now looking back on it a little bit, is that we always asked the First Nations peoples from these different places for permission to come. We never said we're coming. We said, would it be a good idea to come? Is it possible for us to come to honor the Native peoples of this place? And that out in the East Coast is something that's rare. Like these guys had said nobody had asked for permission to come to this place in they were saying hundreds of years, right? And so this was an opportunity, I think, to to celebrate Native knowledge. It's certainly an opportunity to look at the ways at which we are more common than we are different. And so it ended up bringing a lot of people together to make it all happen, because the effort to coordinate it is massive.
This rising of Native peoples is so much part of the story, because I know in South Africa, Desmond Tutu mentioned that it was the Earth's oldest peoples and the youngest coming together.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
We went to the cave in Mossel Bay in Africa, where they had found the earliest settlement of humans that they have found yet. And then, you know, there's a canoe parked outside. And Hawaii is the last, right? The last hardest to find. You know, you need a deep sea watercraft and this amazing technology called non-instrument navigation to get here. This is the last place to get settled. And we went there and to honor the first ones who, you know, started to figure out how this all fit together. That was an amazing day, that day in those caves.
You're making me remember that when the voyage started, part of the idea was to establish that the first Hawaiians traveled with intention here to these islands. Not Alehu, that was proven. But where were they going? Where did they think they were going?
You know, when you ask that question, like, where were they going? It's like, you know, we could ask the same question every time a space shuttle launches into space. It's like, where are they going? Why are they going there, right? And it has to do with that simple question of, well, what's out there? You know, there's this adventurous spirit in us that says, well, what's out a little further past that? And what about past that? And you know, that sense of explorationism, I think, drives us to this day. 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, I think that same spirit was there. Now, they just happened to have Stone Age tools, the powerful gift of observation, and the kind of ingenuity and problem solving that maybe we don't even possess to this day. But they took an impossible problem set, right? I mean, I just sailed last week 2,500 miles, the same route that would have been sailed.
Just got off the canoe.
I just got off the canoe. The same route for the first time for me that was sailed for thousands of years to get people here, to bring all of our ancestors here. And it's far. There's no land in between the two. It's far and it's open. And I'm wondering the same question on board a canoe a couple of weeks ago that you just asked, like, what were they doing out here?
Where did they think they were going? I mean, when we go out into space, we can kind of see the point we're going for.
Well, I mean, and I guess I would say that the power of observation is that they could see those points, that the ability for Nainoa's teacher, Maupialuk, to see the clues is entirely different than what the students now see, right? The depth of knowledge, the understanding. I mean, I've seen him do it. I saw him do it.
What's that like, Na'alehu?
It's like...
Was he reading the world with his body?
Yeah, it's like watching these navigators on this last trip observe and learn and find direction and struggle and then get to the end of 2,500 miles and be just a few miles off. Means to me, like, this is this amazing turn of events that has been building for really thousands of years, really.
At the last, there always seems to be something like faith or trust in there.
Yeah. The day we found land, we saw Maui. We didn't see the Big Island. It was shrouded in clouds the whole time. We saw Maui first.
Oh.
We're sailing and sailing, and we get to the morning meeting. We hadn't seen land the day before. We knew we were in the box of where land was. And Bruce Blankenfeld, who's he's a Poe navigator. He came on as like the sailmaster, as like the teacher, basically. He doesn't say anything the whole trip, right? He won't give any navigational clues. He just, you know, he just let the navigators do their thing. And he says, you know, the one piece of advice I have for you guys today is patience. Just be patient. We know it's there. Just wait. It's going to come to you. The land will come to you. And so we're waiting and everybody's watching and there's this humming energy, right? There's this anticipation, right?
You're all looking in the same direction.
No, we found out, like, we know land's below us. We know we're above the Big Island, right? By strategy, we knew we were above the Big Island. We found out and we're looking around. And everybody's watching, and then there's this huge bank of clouds below us, and we know the Big Island's under there, but you can't say, oh, that cloud is land. You have to see the land in order to call it. And then out in front of us, there's this dark, dark, faint, super faint shadow. So we're watching it, and the shadow doesn't move, so it's not a cloud. All day it's just sitting there, and as we get closer, you can start to see the defined edge. And it's sitting there, and it's this defined edge, and then we're waiting, and we're just making sure, right? And then finally, we call it. We say, okay, that's land, and it can't be the Big Island. It has to be Haleakala because of where we know we are, how high we are. And so, you know, everybody celebrates a little bit, and we call it. And so then, at that point, the strategy changes, right? We say, okay, we found land. We know it's Maui. Mm-hmm. The navigational experiment is over, and so we take a plot. We want to know where we are on a lat-long plot because they want to start to do the measurements to where we got to go, and also they want to know how far out they were. So Bruce calls Nainoa on a satellite phone, and he says, hey, we saw Maui, Haleakala, and this long pause. And Nainoa says, no way. You're too far away. And Bruce says, no, we see it. And Nainoa says, I'm watching you guys on the tracker. You guys are too far away. And Bruce says, well, we just took a picture of it. We're going to send it to you. I fire up the satellite. I sent it over, and there's this Mauna in the frame, right? Sent over, and he calls back, and he's like, you guys, this is like the math is impossible, and yet there's this island sitting there looking for you, waiting for you. That when we took the plot, we were 130 miles away from the island. There's these books that say the height of the mountain versus, you know, the climate that you're in is going to give you a range, a circle of how far away you can see that thing. They're saying like these mountains, the farthest you can see them is 120 miles. But they had seen it all morning, right? Yeah, I don't know. Unexplainable, but it's just the mana of the voyage. Again and again and again, you see these things.
Yeah. Can you take us on board, maybe to a nighttime there? Because I have a feeling that you stand out in the sky at night and you're different than we are.
Yeah. For the last 20 years of sailing, I've only stood one watch. It's the 2-6 watch. Mm-hmm. So it's 2-6 in the afternoon, and then it's 2-6 in the morning. And the reason why I stand that watch is because as a photographer, it means that I'll be up for every sunrise and sunset and golden hour. And so I'll shoot in and around those times. But the 2-6 watch is my favorite because you come up at 2 a.m. And everybody goes down. And so there's only three or four of you on the deck.
What are you supposed to be doing?
On the watch, we're taking control of the vessel. So there's a watch captain who runs the three or four people on the watch. And our primary job is to hold the course. In the Northern Hemisphere, the North Star was right in front of us. We could see the Southern Cross would be almost setting behind us. We would have Maui's fishhook off our port stern. And then the one thing that we waited for every morning was we would just wait for Venus to rise on our starboard beam. And Venus is really, really bright in the morning. And so even when it was cloudy, you could still see the glow of Venus before the glow of the sun came up and the sun filled the sky. And so Venus is a great navigational marker, a great navigational tool. So a lot of times we would use Venus for hours at a time and just steer and just hold the course. But nighttime is great because it really, it's the tempo of the canoe changes. The energy changes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can go hours and nobody says anything. So you'll hear maybe just a couple of words from the navigator. Oh, come up. Okay, come down. And then once the course is set, nobody says anything. We're quiet. And we're observing and just taking it all in. And like I feel like it's like our time to be with the canoe, just us, just three or four of us, which is entirely different than when there's 13 on board and everybody's up and we're all moving around. So it's a quiet time, real personal time, just getting to be in the rhythm of the voyages that happens in that time.
Boy, that's the kind of time you never get on land.
No, not at all. There's such a different energy when you're out on the water. So many things you're not in control of. You know, here we try to take control of everything, right? There's no watches on board. You know, they tell time by what stars are out. The watch is a navigational device, so those get taken. Certainly, you know, our need to be somewhere washes away. It's like, hey, we get there when we get there. You know, dictated by weather.
Does living in Hawaii mean anything different after a trip like this?
Mm. You know, we have this male lady up at our place, at our office, who always talks story. You know, and I'll disappear for months at a time, right? I go on the canoe, I come back, and, you know, and she knows where the guys that working on the voyage. And so I saw her just before I left on this trip. And she says, hey, okay, I'm going to take a vacation. Where's the best place you went? She tells me, where's the best place, right?
You should know.
And right, you've been all these places. Where's the most beautiful place you went? And I go, Auntie, you know what? This is the most beautiful place, right here. All these places we went, incredible stories, incredible people, but, you know, we cannot take Hawaii for granted. This is the most beautiful place. And so, to answer your question, right, we come back, and it's like, I come back more fierce in wanting to protect this place and take care of it. And then the spirit of what comes out in the canoe is like, it's not woe is me, what are we going to do? It's like, let's figure it out. They figured out how to get here. They figured out how to hang out here for a couple of thousand years. Let's figure out what's next. Let's figure out how to do it together as an island community, as a place that has been resilient for all these thousands of years, with just the last couple hundred as the hiccup, I think. So we'll figure it out.
It's so heartening to have this demonstration of acceptance of risk and courage.
You know, for us, right, like, you go to business school, they talk about mitigation of risk in business. You know, how do you what is the acceptable risk quotient? We talk about it going around the planet. You cannot mitigate the risk down to zero anymore. There's so many variables out there that the risk quotient is much higher. So what is the reward? Right? The reward is not just for the crew members on board. The reward is bringing to light the incredible stories of hope from around the planet, the intent of how and why we are doing this voyage. And then the reward is all of these images and these stories that come back to provide us with the perspective to then find our way. That's what made sense to me as to why we were going to put forth so much effort as OEVTV, as all of these photographers getting on, as crew members, was because we were actually mitigating the risk by bringing the reward floor up. So that, yeah, we're going to take risk, but what is the potential after this? And how big does it get if we help to provide an audience? We help to feed that audience and then have all these stunning images and these pieces of film that will make sure that this is so well documented that nobody can forget about this voyage.
Our learning from this voyage is going to continue thanks to the treasures that OEVTV now has.
Yeah. I mean, we could be editing for the next 4 or 5 years just on this material.
Mm-hmm.
The voyage section on our server set is like 60 terabytes.
Oh, yeah.
We're probably near 5,000 hours at this point. We're well past four, hundreds of thousands of images. You know, we're working on the film, right? So,
yeah.
So we've been actively kind of working on the film for about a year. And so now I think the strategy is like really trying to capitalize on the momentum that the voyage has. So that means we got to be done this year. there's a film festival kind of circuit that you have to do, which means you have to be done in the fall.
Oh, my gosh. Are we going to get a preview at the opening ceremony?
You are. So,
uh-huh.
You know what's so great, right, is that there's people, like 300 people that have been involved in the voyage, and they come from all these different communities, right? So it's no longer like, oh, yeah, I saw that guy on TV, and, you know, I want to be like him. It's like, oh, that's my neighbor. That's my teacher. That's the kid down the street. That's the real inspiring part, is because these small communities have these heroes that's cut from their cloth. Regular guys, you know, who do these extraordinary things. And I think that's such an inspiring part of it. You know, when we toured Papa Mao all those years ago, the crew members would come out, and that was the best part, was that they got to tell their stories to their community about, oh, yeah, I met him, and when we were on this trip, and it was so... It was a starting point. It wasn't the film wasn't the end. It was the starting point of a conversation.
Mm, man, I can see this happening in libraries, you know, elementary cafetoriums, you name it.
Hey, we got people from around the planet want us to bring the film back. I got people emailing us saying, how much money do we need to raise to bring the film out next
and
year?
And a couple people, too. A couple crew members.
Yeah.
Make it happen.
Yeah. This further allows the voyage and the values from the voyage to reverberate across, right? Each one of these ports only got to see what happened at their port. We have a very powerful set of tools now that we can use to reactivate each of those ports when there's a film nearby. I mean, I'm thinking we're doing a couple hundred screenings next year around the planet, whether it's in the, you know, the film festival structure. Or just people who have invited us back.
Right.
Or crew members from other places who want to take the film and you know, and show it. I mean, I think all of those are ways at which we want to just make sure that we can support to keep the essence of the voyage going.
I can see that just being greeted by choruses of, we can.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and yeah, I mean, I think in this day and age, you know, we need those powerful stories of determination. For good stuff.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Alejo. Thank you for having me. This is, I haven't really had any time to reflect until just now.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.